Hello, and welcome to the Og Blog Podcast. I am, as ever, your host, your voice. I'm Nat Gertler, professional peanuts nerd. The Og Blog Podcast is produced by About Comics. About Comics is your source for the obscure work of Charles M. Schulz, or reprints of the classic Negro Motorist Green Book, or even an audiobook about Israel Bond, Secret Agent Oi Oi 7. We tickle some pretty particular tastes here at About Comics. Today's podcast, we're doing a little bit of an experiment. I'm actually podcasting and blogging roughly the same material today. I'm going to be winging the podcast somewhat, but it's still a review of the same book and covering much the same information. So it's up to you whether you want to read it or listen to it. And for those of you unfamiliar with the blog, you can find it at aug.com. That's A-A-U-G-H.com. Now, I heard recently from someone that a certain person in the peanuts world, we'll put it that way, someone of significance, had referred to me as professorial. And that gave me quite a pause. I never thought of myself as professorial. Couldn't quite figure out what that meant. I thought about it for a while. There are many ways of taking the word professorial. I mean, it could be that you're simply intelligent, or that you could go depth into detail, or it could be you're long and boring, and people only listen to you when they're forced to, when there's credits involved. There are other ways to look at professorial as well. It could mean that I like tweed jackets with patches on the elbows, and in fact, I have one of those. I wore it for a long time, need to get a new one. So, after considering it carefully for a while, I realized that the very fact that I was breaking it down into this many possibilities suggested that at least some definitions of professorial would apply. However, while I may be professorial, I am certainly not an academic. I am not a teacher. I have plenty of teachers in my family. I've got a sister who is a respected professor of philosophy. That's right, she went for a doctorate in philosophy and ended up earning a good living off of that. Would not have been my advice to her, but my advice is often not worth the paper I don't bother printing it on. But I am not an academic. I don't do academic studies. I research what's interesting to me and what's fun to me and not necessarily what's important in any given circumstance. That's just the way that I am. I do not dwell in the world of ponderous papers and rigid references. Most of the reading that I do for my work is comics. I like that. Believe me, that's a good job you can have when you have to read a lot of comics. And I write about comics. I try to write for the average person to read, not for academics to read. You know. So the book I'm looking at today, The Comics of Charles Schulz, The Good Grief of Modern Life, it's a new collection of academic essays from the University of Mississippi Press. It's not aimed directly at me, but it's nonetheless within the realm of my interest. So I put on my professorial hat, waded into it. Now, gotta say, that title, The Comics of Charles Schulz, it's peanuts. The book is about peanuts. The book has a couple of basically footnote references to the existence of other things by Charles Schulz besides peanuts. I say that as someone who has an interest in the non-peanuts work of Charles Schulz. As I mentioned at the head of the broadcast, I published some of the non-peanuts work of Charles Schulz. But also willing to look into peanuts beyond the strip, beyond the comics, as it were, into the animated peanuts and the use of peanuts and licensing. But there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with a book about peanuts. It's a fascinating topic. I've written a couple books about it myself, not always focusing just on the newspaper strip. Now, I read this book over the course of about a month, essay at a time, piece at a time, when I had the time. And that month ended about a month ago. I wrote the review during the course of the month since. So not everything was always fresh in my mind. And sometimes that's a good way to judge a work, to see what sits in your mind a month later or sometime later. But with that in mind, realize the things at the end of the book I may have more specific ideas on or may be fresher in my mind. And I'll cover each of the pieces one at a time. Again, reminding you that I'm not necessarily the audience for this book. Now, but the first essay in it was on something that's of interest to me. Peppermint Patty's Desire, Charles Schulz and the Queer Comics of Failure, was written by Ben Saunders. And it's a look at Peppermint Patty in regard to lesbianism. Now, that's not a shocker. And it's actually a reasonable topic. The fact that it's used for cheap jokes in every let's make Peanuts adult humor attempt, that's one thing. People go for the easy and recyclable jokes. But it is actually a legitimate topic. Peppermint Patty has a subtextual alignment with lesbianism. And provided a very embraceable queer symbol at a time when there weren't necessarily a whole lot of symbols in mass pop culture for queer individuals to grab onto. And that's a valuable thing. That's identification. Identification is useful. Now, Saunders makes a lot of good statements along the way about Peppermint Patty's awkwardness and how her struggles align with queer concerns. Along the way, however, he dispenses with those who note that Peppermint Patty, despite being a tomboy, has textual hetero impulses by acting as if the only textual support for her being heterosexual is her desire for Charlie Brown. And he makes actually a reasonable case that she doesn't so much desire Charlie Brown as she wants him to desire her. Now, that's a good point. That's something worth noting. And it sort of fits in with Peppermint Patty's situation, being a latchkey kid. No mother, father seems to come home late, not always there. So the desire for attention, a desire to be desired, that's certainly understandable. Interesting way of viewing it. But her relationship with Charlie Brown is not the only textual heterosexuality that's there. The person writing this essay ignores the fact that she had a boyfriend for a while. She was going out with Pigpen in the strip. And while she saw Pigpen as a fixer-upper, one can reasonably assume that many people see areas for Pigpen to improve in that don't require some gender switch. Now, none of this to say that Peppermint Patty does not end up growing up and having lesbian relationships. Certainly among lesbians I know, many of them dated men or boys or whatever at some point in their life. Whether that is an example of them trying out something that didn't work, or whether it's an example of the fluidity of human sexuality varies actually from case to case. But if you want what's textual, her lesbianism isn't established. And there's dangers to stereotyping all girls who might be described as tomboys as lesbians. You know, don't want to force that bucket on anyone. Human beings come in a great variety. But I still think it's wonderful that she was there as a symbol that can be grabbed onto. If feeling Peppermint Patty is one of you, whoever you are, that's a great thing. That's a good thing to have. And I think the essay is overall worthwhile, even though, as I say, it overlooks that important Pigpen point. The next essay was There Has to Be Something Deeply Symbolic in That, Peanuts and the Sublime by Anne C. McCarthy, which is actually mostly about the strips in which Lucy pulls the football away from Charlie Brown. Couldn't tell that by the title, could you? But it, of course, it views it through Immanuel Kant's view of the sublime. When I took a quick glance at that essay while writing the review, I didn't even really remember reading it. So it didn't settle in for me. Saying, Showing, and Schultz, The Typography and Notation of Peanuts by Roy T. Cook is the next piece. And this is the one I didn't finish. It was so grounded in a fundamental misunderstanding of how comics work that reading it was making me mad. There were a few items along the way that led to it, but really the thing that set it down for me that this was not going to be something that I could agree with in the slightest was when they talked about how seeing musical notes in the strip or in comics at all, when we see those, we imagine we hear music. That's what he was saying. And then that may be the case for some people or in some instances, but in general, what musical notes make us do is recognize that the character is hearing music, that there's music there. We're not necessarily hearing it ourselves. We're not turning everything in the strip into a movie. He was writing it as if a comic strip, it doesn't exist as a comic strip, but merely sort of some sort of encoded version of a movie that is unlocked in our mind, that this is some sort of MIDI, that's a computer system of musical notation. It's a bunch of code that lets a computer play a piece of music. And again, that may be works for some people or in some instances, but it's not the general basis of how comics work. And I'm saying that as somebody who's been creating comics for decades now. This felt to me like an academic just getting it wrong, and I couldn't finish it. But I moved on to Consuming Childhood, Peanuts and Children's Consumer Culture in the Postwar Era by Lara Sagaswag, or I'm guessing on the pronunciation, I apologize, to Ms. whoever she is, if I'm getting it wrong. Not the best at pronouncing strange words. I get reader's disease, actually. Even there's some common words that I mispronounce because I've been reading them all my life but not listening to them. Anyway, but this essay is the sort of essay that I want to see in a book like this, if the book was for me. The writer takes a solid base of knowledge of something outside the central topic and is using that to give context to the central topic. In this case, it delves into how the world transitioned into seeing children as consumers and the way in which those changes were reflected in the strip. As we're talking about a period of time. It used to be you didn't advertise to kids. The products, except for specifically toys, weren't aimed at kids or marketed to kids so much. Everything was going through the adults and adult views. And that was really changing during the period in which Peanuts started coming out. So it's a good piece. The next one, How Can We Lose When We're So Sincere? Varieties of Sincerity in Peanuts by Leni Brielli is a readable essay on what the nature of sincerity is, or natures, really. There's more than one type of sincerity, perhaps. And the various ways that's reflected and discussed in the strip. And the ways in which sincerity is true or not true of the very strip itself. Is it a sincere strip? Absolutely, at times. Jeffrey O. Seagrave offered up, I thought I was winning it in the game of life, but there was a flag on the play. Sport in Charles Schulz's Peanuts. And it's a reasonable overview of how Schulz used baseball, football, competitive snowman building, and more to express and develop character and to comment on the world of sports as it was practiced in the latter part of the 20th century. It does resist being a light read, as you know, that was never its goal. A sentence like, the message encoded in Charlie Brown's Athletic Tribulations is that while life may well be futile, perhaps even absurd, and certainly comic, while death is inevitable and fame ephemeral, and while the heaviness of the Weltschmerz is inescapable, nobility lies not in the victory, but in the challenge. It speaks reasonable truth, but, well, I love a good semicolon, but pause at having more than one in this sentence. But hey, I write comics. There's only so much one can fit in a word balloon. Footballs and Autumn Lifts, Charlie Brown in Coconino by Michael Tisserand. This is a look at Peanuts relative to the comic strip Crazy Cat, including not just parallels, but to what degree a relatively late introduction to the Crazy Cat strip might have influenced Schulz. The writer, who's author of Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, biography of the creator of Crazy Cat, which has got really good notices. I haven't read it myself. Is obviously coming from a strong base of knowledge. My limitation in this article is that I'm not well-versed in Crazy Cat. I've read very little of it. And while I possibly should settle down to a nice middle-of-the-run volume and throw myself into it, as I gather one should, folks' suggestions that I do so often come across less as recommendations and more as prescriptions. I'm more interested in enjoying the strip than in appreciating and respecting it, much as that may be due. Anyway, the piece is well written and comprehensible, and it's all on me that I wasn't invested in it. Schulz in the Late 60s, Snoopy's Signs of the Times by Joseph J. Dorowski, puts the comic into the context of the times in ways that often instinctively seem obvious to me, but I have to remind myself that I was alive in the late 1960s. Not by much, perhaps, born in the middle of that decade, but I got to see it firsthand and view the world from immediately after. So that's my perspective on things. And the things that are obvious now may be less obvious and become less obvious as time goes by. But he does delve in well about how some of Snoopy's World War I adventures looked viewed through the Vietnam era in which they actually appeared. But that opens up a question for me. When is the most effective time to look into the context of something? I mean, if you look at it too soon, if you look at it when it's happening, you're not necessarily really aware of what your context is. Everything that's going on seems just the way things are, and less the way things are at the moment. If you look at it too much later, you're also not really necessarily aware of the way things are, but more sort of perhaps a nostalgic view of the way things were, whatever the popular perspective is in portraying an era. The 1960s weren't all hippies. Not everybody in the 1950s was either a beat poet or Donna Reed. We tend to simplify the times and sometimes give it a glossy sheen it doesn't deserve. So when is the ideal time to look back at something? And maybe the answer is you have to keep looking back at the same thing at different times and look at it from different ways, get the different point of view of a given era. Franklin and the Early 1970s by Christopher P. Lehman. Now, this is a good overview of Franklin, why he was put in the strip, and why he persisted when other bland characters in the strip disappeared, but also as very non-bland characters in other strips failed to take hold. It reflects on how Franklin was on the forefront of integration of the comics page, but missed his chance to take a similar spot on television, not appearing on television until 1973, but that in ways he was actually better served on TV than in the strip. Now, I think at times the author makes too much of a single strip. There was one strip early on where it was mentioned that Franklin's father was in Vietnam, and I think that's a fascinating fact, but it's really not mentioned again, and therefore doesn't become that big a part of his character. I've always wanted to see more done with it. Actually, when I was working on the Peanuts comic book, I proposed at least one story that made reference to Franklin's father being stationed overseas. Obviously, I avoid saying Vietnam. That doesn't have the same impact today as it did back when, but I think the idea of being a serviceman stationed overseas still has a lot of similar impact, even if the particular places he's likely to be are different. Or he makes a lot of the one strip in which Peppermint Patty makes some crack about the number of black hockey players in the NHL, which is at the very least an awkward strip. But again, it's just one strip, and if you missed that one, you wouldn't see that same color in the rest of the run of the Franklin strips. But if he's paying too much attention to a couple of details, possibly, there are worse things to say about an essay than that it pays too much attention to detail. So it's a good piece. Another one of the good essays in this, particularly good essays, is Making a World for All God's Children, A Charlie Brown Christmas and the Aesthetics of Doubt and Faith by Ben Novotny Owen. This takes a look at the first Peanuts animated special, Charlie Brown Christmas. So, again, we're getting away from the strip itself, although in this case, at least in case of A Charlie Brown Christmas, it's actually written by Charles Schulz himself. So, almost within the official realm of the title. But it's another one where it takes some real specific knowledge of things outside of Peanuts and applies them rather than just viewing it through some theoretical or philosophical lens. In this case, it's dealing with the creative choices that were involved in Charlie Brown Christmas in terms of things such as animation style and the vocal styles that were used. And it's explaining both how those things serve A Charlie Brown Christmas, how that sort of limited animation and the stiff child voices serve its concept of authenticity that's at the base of the special, and how they arise from things that were going on in animation in the years leading up to that, particularly the UPA animation, which was taking a rather limited form of animation and making it work, making the limited aspect, and by limited animation we mean not fully drawn new frames every moment, but keeping things simple, which worked in ways that didn't just make it look like it was a cheap form of lush animation, but as a stylistic choice, much as an abstract painting isn't just somebody who's trying to draw something really well and getting it wrong. So I think this, again, as an essay, is a very informative and interesting one, and I was glad to read it. Charles Schulz, Comic Art and Personal Value by M.G. Clark, on the other hand, is a look at the prices that get paid for original Peanuts art, and through that lens, pop culture-related art in general, and how the values don't align with the sort of calculated values of people normally investing in art. And the author is acting as if there's something really strange about people paying money for something and being willing to pay an amount of money for something based on how it personally impacts them and how it reminds them or links them to something that they really like. Maybe I'm coming from an odd spot on this. I collect comic book art myself, comic book and comic strip art. Don't have any Peanuts originals, but I've got some Peanuts-related originals, and I've got art by some of the great superhero artists and things like that. And I value having these things partly because I think it's really cool to have art by these people who did stuff I like and art that is part of the process of making the things I like. So I don't see why it should be so surprising or essay-worthy that is reflected in the value of things. So maybe that's just me. Charlie Brown Cafes and the Marketing of Peanuts in Asia by Ian Gordon gets into something that I'm actually a little interested in. I've covered some of the Charlie Brown restaurants in some of my Peanuts writing, some of the Peanuts restaurants that have shown up in Asia. And there have been a number of different rounds of licensed Peanuts places. But it doesn't seem to work for me as an academic essay, in large part because much of what it has to say about these various restaurants and cafes comes from a handful of online reviews of the places. And that doesn't seem to be a great meaningful source for an in-depth look at what these were like, were and are. Some of them survive, some of them do not. And it seems like something that might make a somewhat interesting blog post. And maybe I've got my standards for academia set too high, but that's just my reaction. Now, Chips Off the Old Blockhead, Evidence of Influence in Peanuts Parodies, by Gene Kennenberg Jr. Now, this one I had high hopes for. I love a good overview of Peanuts parodies. What are the common factors, how they reflect both Peanuts and the world beyond Peanuts, how they change over time, so forth and so on. And I like Kennenberg. We exchange messages from time to time online. However, this essay was aimed at a specific audience, being an expanded version of a talk that he gave to the Modern Language Association convention. This explains why the focus is on the communicative aspects of a few key parodies. It also explains why midway through he refers to something as a final example of Peanuts parody, and then goes on to discuss several more. The expansion may not have been perfectly smoothed in. Anyway, the work is academic in ways that I'm not that interested in. The moment I run into the word semiotics in any reading, my brain tells me I'm about to hit a morass where I'm going to spend more time and effort decoding what is being said than I will gain value out of it. I could treat it as a puzzle to work out what is being said, and hey, I like a good puzzle, but then the victory comes in the decoding, and I'm not experiencing the work as intended. The failure here is my failure, not the work. This seems like a good work for the right audience, and it was created for what sounds like the right audience. Just not me. Now, clearly this book as a whole, it's not for everyone. It may well be for you. It's hard for me to tell from this side of the microphone, but I'm waving hi to you from here. You can't hear that, can you? Anyway, if it sounds like it's for you, you can buy the $65 hardcover version, which is what they sent me for review. Got a free review copy. I should tell you that for reasons of transparency, and also to encourage other people to send me free review copies, because almost nobody does. Or you can wait a few months, and it's coming out in April for $25 in paperback, or you can get the Kindle version right now for about $15. So that may well serve you. So that's it for this time. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, if you want to let me know whether I was smart to do a recorded version of something that's on the blog, or whether this just seemed like a waste of time, you can let me know at questions@augh.com. That's AAUGH.com. And so, until next time, may the birds find someplace else to play their noisy games of bridge. May your blanket-hating grandma mellow the heck out. And may all your griefs be good ones.